You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 21 October, we've got Netflix results due after market close tonight. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Pietri Rodenhey, Serenia Capital Advisors. Nuclear. I've chatted with Pietri around nuclear / uranium before, but now we're talking about power stations locally. Of course, there's also AI demand. I want to revisit this thesis. Quinton Rossi from Spear REIT results. Loan to value almost halves, but they got a lot of deals coming. I suspect that's going to return to normal. John Cherry from Cherry Flava. Willie's challenges. ShopRite has been capturing customers at scale. He wrote a note if he were CEO of Woolies for a day. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. Why a nearly 7% difference between the S&P 500 and the Satrix S&P 500 ETF? It is the Rand, which is stronger. Business Day, Stefanucci stocks shares surge on $685 million Eskom payout. Latest win helps to restore confidence in the group after a trading update in May cast doubt over its financial health. Morning markets, US was green, S&P 1.1% up, Nasdaq 1.3% higher, Easter's all green, Sydney 0.5%, Tokyo 0.5%, Hong Kong almost 2% higher, and Tencent just over 2% higher. Commodities, mostly green, gold futures, 4,366. Brent is the red at 6,079. Platinum, 1,648. Palladium, 1,540. The Rand is 1,723. Bitcoin, 109,500. And a top 40 opening call, red open, but 60 points or less than a tenth of a percent lower.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Training now with Pietri Rodenhey, Herenia Capital Advisors. Pietri, appreciate the morning time. You and I have talked nuclear uranium before. It was an investment thesis you liked. If anything, that thesis has gotten stronger. We've got our energy minister saying that we want to spend a couple of trillion, although those pebble bed nuclear reactor modules have never really proved themselves, but nonetheless. And of course, all the demand for AI. Are you still liking the story? Are you still liking the Global X Uranium ETF? Have you got a different way to play it? What's your thinking here?
Good morning, and thanks for chatting. And yes, I very much still am a fan of the energy complex at large, and particularly nuclear. I think that the world is kind of scrambling for more and more energy, and nuclear is really kind of one of the only ways that is sustainable from a clean energy perspective, right? And what we have really is we have a market that is in deficit. So as you mentioned, it takes a lot of money and a long time to build a power station.
Yeah.
So there is quite a long lagging effect of when you need the fuel. If you look, for example, in George in the U.S., they took from 2007 to 2024 to build, one power station, and that cost $30 billion, which was originally estimated at $14 billion, right? So it takes, call it two decades, and a huge mountain of money to build a power station. But once done, it produces power incredibly efficiently. So we have a situation where in the uranium space there is this undersupply, right? So global reactor demand at this stage is something like 180 million pounds worth of enriched uranium.
Mm-hmm.
Current supply is around 130 to 140 million pounds of enriched uranium. So you've got a shortfall, right, of 20 to 25% of demand. So you've got a very tight market in something that is becoming increasingly more popular and more in demand. Demand is growing. We're seeing lots of countries come to the party saying that, we are willing to change policies. We are willing to start building new types of reactors. And this is, even IT companies or you know, tech companies.
Yeah.
I suppose nobody calls them IT companies anymore. But large-scale tech companies saying, look, we'll build our own nuclear power stations. We need the power to drive AI. This is a very exciting sort of space for things like the uranium price. So, yes, there's the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF, which is really nice. There's also just sort of ETFs that focus on the physical price of uranium. So that's probably the best way for us.
Which are those? Because they perhaps the earlier winners. Which are those focusing on that spot uranium price?
So there's U.U.N. So it's basically just U. that's a very nice. It's a very nice one. So that's probably the best, one for us, I would say. It's just u.n.
Yeah, okay. I see it there. And the thing to your point, I mean, this is long-term, and it takes forever to build the power station. But we are also seeing stations being recommissioned. I'm thinking the Three Mile Island. I mean, the demand is coming through by some recommissioning at the same time.
Yeah. And you've got, basically you've just got a situation where you've got an incredibly tight market, right? And people have been very negative on something for a very long time. And it's like really, our view is that it's probably the only actual sustainable form of green energy there is. Yes, solar is great and fully dependent households. Like in South Africa, for example, it's very, very useful. But if you want to solve energy in South Africa completely,
you
need a power station.
That is exactly what the minister said on the weekend. Let's build some nuclear power stations. We'll leave it there. Pietie Rodenhuis, Serenia Capital Advisors. Appreciate the early morning. And that's our poll today. LinkedIn and Twitter. Is nuclear/uranium on your investment watch list? Certainly, everyone's talking about it. Go back 13 years, Fukushima. Everyone was turning them off. Now we're turning them on. Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn and Twitter. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Chatting now with Quinton Rossi, CEO of Spear REIT. Results for 6 months ending August saw revenue up a little over 25%. HEPS 11.88% higher. Distribution per share up 5.21%. Quinton, appreciate the early morning. Strong set of numbers. But let's touch first on your loan to value. It was 27 and a bit in the previous period, down to sub 14%, which to my mind seems a little low. But you've got some deals that will close in H2, will that push that loan-to-value back to target range? And I suppose, what is your target range for a loan-to-value number?
Morning, Simon, and thanks for having me, and morning to your listeners. Simon, our strategy is always to operate between a 38 to 43% loan-to-value at any given time. Depends on where we are in the interest rate cycle, and also how much of our debt is hedged and how much of our debt is floating. The LTV is extraordinarily low at the moment because we did in June this year, we raised $749 million of new equity from our shareholders to position Spear for the three acquisitions which we are in the process of implementing at this point in time between October and say January, between October 2025 and January 2026. The total value of those acquisitions is about $1.074 billion, and 45% of the purchase consideration is funded via debt, and the balance will be funded via cash. So over the next 18 to 24 months, you'll see the loan-to-value move in a northerly direction, but actually still well below our strategic band. It'll only move to roughly 30 to 31%, which also includes allocation towards some of our development projects that we're working on. So a very healthy balance sheet. In our world, options are assets, and the balance sheet where it is now and where it's going with a 30% loan to value certainly gives us deal making optionality and also first mover advantage, given the fact that we're in the region and we're in the trenches.
And the deals you're doing, the yields you're getting, those initial yields, I mean, they are above cost of capital. This is, I mean, you're in that ideal sweet spot. You got the capital and you've got assets you can get that are paying well.
No, quite right. And I think what is transpiring in our market is that more and more investors that own direct property see the benefit of potentially disposing to the likes of Spear, where they can be exposed in an indirect manner to listed real estate, either through a Section 42 asset for share swap, or taking part script, part cash, and part and the balance being debt settled for their facilities. So when you're funding off of a 45% loan to value, when your counterparty has a very strong sense of certainty that the transaction will materialize and the execution risk is almost eliminated from the transaction. So we are able to buy well. We are value investors. We are looking for acquisitions that will be accretive to the fund and that will enhance earnings for shareholders. There's no reason for us to go and acquire assets that are dilutive to the portfolio. We're not just growing the business for the sake of growth. We are an income fund seeking quality, sustainable cash flows, tenants, good quality tenants, and assets in great locations. And over the last 2 years, if you look back at the Emira transaction and the last three transactions we've just done, we've achieved exactly that, which is completely in line with our investment strategy.
Absolutely. Your industrial sector, it's of gross lettable areas by just over 60%. In terms of revenue, it's a little over 41%. It is sort of the flagship in many senses. And vacancies, down in, 3.5%. You're getting positive rental reversions. Industrial down in the Western Cape, Cape Town area, where you are focused, having a very strong performance.
No, absolutely. And I think, we've got a mountain on the one hand and an ocean on the other and a constraint in supply, not just of existing stock, but also of available land and zoned land. Coupled with the higher cost of construction, it's a great space to own a large industrial portfolio. And what makes our industrial portfolio further unique is the fact that we own assets across almost the value proposition of industrial, from mini size units to urban logistics to distribution to warehousing and to logistics and manufacturing facilities. So we really can kind of almost be a bit of a proxy for the industrial subsector within the Cape market. And it's boded extremely well for us. And we've seen fantastic returns from that portfolio.
How's commercial, which is another big space for you? And obviously, I mean, the key thing here is the office. We've chatted before. It's been improving. Is it still improving? Has it got to a point yet where do we get back to pre-pandemic sort of numbers? I suppose at some point we do, in terms of vacancies and reversions. How are you finding at this point?
Yeah, I think the Cape market, certainly from a commercial perspective, has decoupled itself from, call it, the rest of the South African commercial market. Mm-hmm. We are sitting in a position where there just is not enough supply coming on stream, which is now pushing the commercial market for the first time in probably 8-9 years into more of a development phase, with new stock possibly coming on stream over the next 9 to maybe 18 months. So that has boded very well for rental growth. So we've seen double-digit rental growth in the office space within the Cape market. We've also seen a contraction in vacancies of your P-grade, AAA, and A-grade accommodation, which actually is currently trading better than pre-COVID. And the Cape market is very unique in the sense that the market was never a speculative office market. You saw in nodes like Rosebank and Sandton, you had a big kind of drive by the larger funds to create scale and to create office scale quickly. The Cape was very different. There it was more on a demand basis. And I think that was one of the things that shielded the Cape commercial market from the deep vacancy conundrums that you find in places like Johannesburg and areas where, and obviously that's also coupled with municipal decline.
The municipality
within the Cape, in all established nodes across the commercial, retail, industrial, residential sector, have maintained an extremely high standard of municipal infrastructure, which again has also boded well for companies saying, well, listen, we're going to move our businesses down to Cape Town, or we're going to plant our flag, our international flag in that we want to put in South Africa, we're going to plant it in Cape Town. And those drivers have boded extremely well for the commercial market. And on the B grade and C grade side, the opportunity there has now become in the residential conversion space, particularly in the CBD, with the likes of the Golden Acre having been sold recently, and that is now being redeveloped into a residential accommodation development.
I got you. Okay. And then more residential conversions happening. We'll leave it there. Quentin Rossi, CEO, Spear REIT. Appreciate the early morning. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with John Cherry. You find him Cherry Flava. John, appreciate the time. A recent note from yourself. If I were the Woolies CEO, before we get to the Woolies CEO part, it really is what's happening at their market regarding ShopRite. And you make the point, yeah, they're great at generating revenue. They're great at generating profit. But what they are perhaps excelling at is capturing customers at scale. Hundreds of new stores, new brands, they are just left, right and center picking up customers that would otherwise be shopping at other retailers, and that is ShopRite's perhaps golden star.
Right. Morning, Simon. Absolutely. You know, if you have a careful look at the recent integrated annual report that they published, I think it's just astounding as to how successful they have been at acquiring customers, and then not just per purchase acquiring them, but then locking them in through their loyalty schemes and through the various businesses that they've got interconnecting with the ShopRite group. They're able to then move customers around their value chain. And if you read between the lines of the annual report, they're starting to call themselves an institution. So they've almost transcended the idea that they're a business. They're now an institution of society. And from that, you know, they're in the business of acquiring customers. That's what their focus is. They look at the numbers of the population of customers that they've acquired, and that's their drive. That's their strategic intent.
And the problem for Woolies then is that customer acquisition cost just absolutely goes through the roof, and I imagine you get less good customers. I mean, you can do, you know, discounting and the like, but that customer is going to be fickle in a sense, and that is a double squeeze on Woolies.
Right, and that's the elephant in the room, because once you are loyal to the ShopRite group for, you know, because you're incentivized to be so, in order for a competitor like Woolies to try and acquire those customers back, to get that market share back, they're going to have to offer audacious promotions or some kind of a radical discount in order to lure them back. And then the real issue is that those customers are poor quality customers.
Yeah.
They're not coming for a long time. They're coming for a good time. So they're there for the discount, and then they'll leave whenever they have the opportunity to go back to their preferred retailer. So that's really the elephant in the room that I think a Woolies CEO really needs to be aware of.
So if you were Woolies CEO for a day, although maybe it needs more than a day, what would you be looking at? Because this is I'm not a retail specialist by any sense, but this is a real squeeze that is not going to be easy to get out of.
Well, first off, let me just say that the work that's being done is not bad work. I think they're not doing anything wrong. What they're trying to do is they're trying to optimize their various businesses. They're having a very careful look at what their strategic risks might be, and they're aware of some of those risks. The issue for me, however, is that the focus is very much internal. They're looking at their brands, they're looking at the positioning of their food business, and that's important, but it doesn't necessarily open up the opportunity for the future. So what I would do is I would take all of the strategy work that's in place and put it to one side and really start asking myself, what is the problem that I'm trying to solve here? And if you really start digging around, the problem that they have is a customer problem.
Yeah.
In the 3 to 5 year time horizon, the squeeze on customer is going to be significant. And that's what I would be doing, is I'd be trying to understand how I can get those customers back with some kind of value that's going to be applicable in the 3 to 5 year time horizon. And not just look at ShopRite, but look at the other factors of change that are coming into the market, because there are many. Quite frankly, what I'd be looking at is looking at the kind of words and the kind of terms that are used internally. One of the things that jumps up to me is this fact that they label their food business as the Holy Grail. That is a term which is problematic, because what you're effectively saying is, don't touch this business. We're not going to innovate this business. It's working very well, so keep it as it is. And that kind of mental positioning is problematic. because then you don't innovate. What they should be doing is looking at that business and going, how do we disrupt this business and make it better? If we had to try and compete with ourselves, what would we do in this instance? That's really what I'd be looking at, as well as trying to connect the various business units together into one strategic intent. At the moment, they're running the various businesses as business units rather than looking at the group as a powerful differentiator in the market.
But I like that use of language. Language is so important. And it makes me, that book of The Innovator's Dilemma of I don't know, some 20-odd years ago, you can't rest back on your laurels. I mean, and to be clear, ShopRite isn't. You've got to look at your business and say, we have to be different in 3 to 5 years, because where we are today is not going to be good enough for that. And that is a brave and audacious and, truthfully, scary.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what strategy is. It's about willingly taking on huge risk. And that's what ShopRite did. They put their balance sheet at risk by investing an enormous amount of money on a strategic play. And it's played out. So now you look back and you go like, wow, that was unbelievable. But it could have been a 1.5 billion rand hole in the ground that they poured money into. So, you know, I think it's the same thing, is that you can't be labeling things holy grail. You've got to be onboarding risk and saying, right, you know, what is an educated play from here on? It's not like we're going to gamble, but at least go through the process of understanding what the problem is and then looking at the options which are most plausible in order to unlock that opportunity.
John Cherry, you find him, Cherry Flava. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. We were chatting with Bastian Trachiba yesterday. He from Prescient Investment Management, talking around our grey listing, the Financial Action Task Force meeting this week. We expect a decision on Friday. We're hoping to be taken off. We asked you if we thought we would. 40% each said yes, finally. The other 40 said either way, we are struggling. The rest said no, still lots to do. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobokle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Young consumers.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.